This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I'm David Canfield, and I'm here for today's episode with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And joining us this week is senior Hollywood correspondent for Vanity Fair, Julie Miller. Hi, Julie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. You're here to lend your expertise on many topics today. We're going to get into the third season of Hacks and how that is crashing, perhaps defining this year's Emmy comedy race. I think there's a lot to say about that. But before we get into that, two big movies coming out this weekend that I think the hope is they get some broadly appealing audience numbers out of it in different ways. One is a streaming movie. One is a theatrical movie. We're talking about The Idea of You with via Prime Video and The Fall Guy, which is hitting theaters on Friday. Let's start with The Idea of You. It seems like the one to start with, Julie, because you wrote a cover story for us on Ms. Anne Hathaway, Ms. Annie Hathaway, as she perhaps likes to be called. And this film stars her along with Nicholas Galitzine in it's a rom-com directed by Michael Showalter. Early reviews are pretty strong, including Richard's. Julie, why don't you set the stage for us on this one?
So this is adapted from a pretty steamy novel that became very popular during the pandemic by Robin Lee about Anne Hathaway's character plays, I guess, an early 40-something divorcee. She has a daughter. She's rediscovering herself, I suppose, for the first time in her independence. And she crosses paths with a hunky heartthrob, the lead singer of a boy band. This happens at Coachella. She takes her daughter there. She somehow winds up bumping into him in the VIP. And the story is all about how this 40-year-old woman, you know, manages this relationship with a 24-year-old heartthrob without losing herself, I suppose, and with indulging in all of her, you know, sexual impulses, we could say.
How did you guys meet? We need to know the story.
We met at Coachella.
Hi.
Hi.
This is your trailer?
Yeah, I'm in the band. We're performing on the main stage.
August Moon?
Yeah.
I'm too old for you.
I don't know.
Did you both see it?
I saw it the old-fashioned way. It's in theaters. I don't know if you guys knew that. I saw it at the Culver Theater here in Los Angeles.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, wow. I guess it's playing in a few theaters right before it's just everywhere on Amazon.
Yeah, I didn't even know until I did a little retcon, and there it was.
I went to the New York premiere this week. I mean, it premiered at South by Southwest, so it was kind of the second premiere, I guess. And it was at Jazz at Lincoln Center, and there was a party afterward. But during the movie, I'd heard of the book, but I didn't know to what extent it was a phenomenon. I didn't know if it was like 50 Shades of Grey level or what, but holy cow, that audience was pretty much screaming the entire time. The climactic scene where they kiss for the first time, which is actually in the film, like it's the way the movie's made, is quiet by design. And yet that was not the effect in my audience. They were just hooting and hollering at everything. They seemed to really eat it up. And I really enjoyed it. I went in sort of not sure what I thought it was going to be. Was it going to lean on comedy? Was it going to lean on drama? It's a little bit of both. And it really just kind of threads the needle very well. I think Showalter, most importantly, takes the material seriously. It's not very like self-consciously like, oh, we know this is silly. Like it just is an earnest movie, well acted and I think well written. So, yeah, I was pleasantly surprised.
He's a very nimble director, that Michael Showalter. This is his first feature since Spoiler Alert, which was a sort of appropriately hammy gay tearjerker starring Jim Parsons. But he's made a lot of strong movies. The Big Sick was probably his cinematic breakout with Kumail Nanjiani. He made The Eyes of Tammy Faye, which won multiple Oscars, including for Jessica Chastain. And he also directed The Dropout, the Emmy-winning Hulu limited series with Amanda Seyfried from a few years ago. And I felt the same way, Richard. With this one, I had a different experience than you, unfortunately, because I don't think anybody knows this is in theaters. So my theater was not particularly full. And I missed what I could tell would be a fun crowd movie, fun crowd experience. But this is a streaming movie. So maybe not a lot of people will get that anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I guess all the better to cuddle up on the couch with your loved one.
It works for that too.
Yeah. And like, it's not, the movie is not like that sex heavy. It's more sort of foreplay than it is, you know, actual acts, let's say. I mean, there is some of that, but you know, Galitzine, who has been kind of everywhere recently, you know, I think he's pretty good in Mary and George. I thought he was pretty good in Red, White, and Royal Blue. But this is kind of a new level for him. Maybe acting opposite Anne Hathaway sort of unlocked something somehow, because she's really good in the movie, I think. It's one of her, like, it's a very, like, grown-up performance, which is fitting of the subject matter. But, like, I just really found her sort of loose and appealing and not, you know, she was very relaxed and kind of downplayed things in an interesting way. Mm. And so Galitzine really grooves with that energy. So the movie would, you know, sort of live or die by the chemistry of its leads, and luckily they have it.
Damn, they are good together.
They sure are. I know Anne's been on that press tour right now talking about how she danced with all of her potential male co-stars instead of kissing. I guess that was once a thing where you kissed your potential male or female lead in an audition. Yeah. But
when you interviewed her, Julie, did she say anything about like why she wanted to do this particular project? Because the end product is actually kind of glossier. It feels like a real movie than something just kind of existing on streaming. But, you know, this movie had the potential to be really cheesy. So what kind of, why did she take this risk, I guess?
It's interesting because it's such a sort of fantasy rom-com when you read the book, but she related to this character in the idea that she is, you know, becoming her fully realized self for the first time and understanding her own identity and moving forward, I guess, with this full set of tools that she didn't have before. So she connected with that element of the character. And it was interesting because she and Michael Showalter actually had different ideas on how to adapt the book. He told me he initially was thinking of this as more of a reverse Notting Hill. But they sort of met in the middle in the book. Anne Hathaway's character is this, I believe she's based in Paris. She's a jet-setting, you know, a glamorous woman. Here, the character is a little bit more grounded. She lives in Silver Lake. She runs her own art gallery. So it's sort of this fusion of Anne Hathaway, where she is in her life as this character, with this fun fantasy rom-com. Hmm.
That's so fascinating. I love the way you put it earlier, Richard, in terms of the rollout of this movie. I feel like so often, even with big star ticket streaming movies, you get like a week of press beforehand where they do the, you know, big morning shows and they have one or two big press interviews, and then the movie's out, and then we stop talking about the movie after 3 days. And Anne Hathaway has done a pretty extensive press run for this movie, beginning with our cover, but she did a big interview with the New York Times. She did a lot of paired stuff with Galitzine, and it's felt like that has added to the pre-conversation around this movie in a way that I find quite refreshing for a streaming movie. And that does exactly what you're talking about, Julie, which is make Anne's participation in it more interesting, because she's very willing and open to talk about exactly why she connected to it and how we should see this movie in relation to her filmography as a whole.
Right. It's interesting because she's such a beautiful actress, of course, but she also was speaking about how lucky she felt that she still has this momentum in her career. And it seems as though she's very versed and, you know, knows the economy of this and the exchange that she, you know, has to do her amount of promotion to, you know, get the roles in exchange. So I feel like she's good at fulfilling both of those responsibilities.
Her career's been interesting in the past few years. Like, she's done some interesting indies and whatnot, but this is kind of the first, like, mainstream thing she's done in a while. Mm-hmm. And so it's really nice to see her back in this kind of big, glossy mode. I mean, she's great in last year's Eileen, stuff like that. You know, I love her, a lot of her indie stuff, but this is another facet of her movie star profile that hadn't been kind of utilized in a while. And I think she found the right project, and it sounds like that, you know, in the kind of doing the adaptation, they found the right through it, because she's still pretty sophisticated and cool. But yeah, she owns a small gallery in LA, and it's not, you know, she's pretty far from, you know, Harry Styles level. And that tension or whatever is makes the movie interesting.
It's been a while since I've liked her in the lead in a big ticket movie like this as much as I do with this movie. But I kind of missed her in this kind of mode, and she delivers.
Yeah. So if you're rolling your eyes at the idea of a somewhat Harry Styles inspired fanficky kind of thing, check it out anyway. I think it's worth it. I was pleasantly surprised by the movie, and I don't mean this any condescending way, because we're basically the same age, but like, it's fun watching an actress like Anne Hathaway, who broke out as, you know, playing teenagers and then sort of, you know, kind of flustered 20-somethings. Like, she always played young, kind of, and it's been really interesting to watch her kind of be an adult. And this movie really highlights that in a way that still lets her have fun and transgress and do all that risky stuff. Mm.
Sometimes you just want to see Anne Hathaway curl up on a couch with a glass of red wine yes. and watch some Graham Norton as she does in this movie.
Yes, exactly.
With us curled up on our own couches, it's beautifully right. symmetrical in that way. Right. Well, from one movie with steamy, starry chemistry to another, The Fall Guy is getting the theatrical treatment. Mm-hmm. This movie very swiftly reunites Barbenheimer stars, Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling, in a rom-com slash action comedy with a lot of stunts, a lot of very good stunts. I was a little bit more mixed on this one. Richard, I'm not sure where you landed, but if you want to set it up for us.
Yeah, I mean, it's based on an old TV show. The writer of the movie is this guy, Drew Pierce, who has worked with the writer-director Shane Black, who did like Iron Man 3 and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. And The Fall Guy shares a lot of that sort of Shane Blacky DNA, in that it's quippy, it's fast, the stakes are pretty low. You know, Gosling plays a stuntman who gets kind of involved in some petty crime, but you're not really worried for anyone's mortal life or anything like that. It's mostly just a kind of a good time movie. And Emily Blunt plays a film director who's directing, you know, the movie that Gosling's working on, and they have a romantic past, and the movie's kind of about them coming back together.
Anyone but him. I didn't approve him. You know that.
You are literally the last person on earth I want to see slap the shit out of you.
I really could.
And I'm open to that in a safer environment.
And I like Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt separate of each other. Like, I think especially recently, Gosling yes. has proven why he has this movie star charisma. I don't think Emily Blunt has ever not had it. she's a very appealing actor. And seeing them together, it just, in something that is sort of laid back, is just really fun. That said, I think that the movie maybe strains a little too hard to act like it's not trying at all, you know? Like, yep. it's an effortlessness that doesn't always work. And without these two stars, I think would fall a lot flatter.
I also found it just kind of ran out of energy. You really feel the mystery, quote unquote, shoehorned in terms of the reveal of who the bad guy is and et cetera, et cetera. But it gets a lot of mileage out of the two of them. I was thinking about the fact that, you know, you feel Ryan Gosling really naturally building off of the Barbie Ken phenomenon and what the new level of stardom he achieved through that movie and the way he sort of cemented his appeal as an actor through that movie. And then watching Emily Blunt in this, I was like, God, it is annoying that her only Oscar nomination is for Oppenheimer, because this is Emily Blunt at her most charming, dynamic, and a reminder of what she can bring to the movie when she's more central. She got a lot of deserved career acclaim for Oppenheimer, but it remains to me a weird asterisk for her in terms of her awards trajectory.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that she, you know, this next decade of her career is marked by stuff like this and Oppenheimer, like more interesting, will be they light action comedies or serious dramas, like just more for her to sort of chew on. You know, I think she's great in Mary Poppins, but that was kind of, you know, like bigger than her in a way. You know, Jungle Cruise, she's good in, but like that movie's not good. You know, I just don't know. I hope for a little bit more like... more thoughtful choices, I suppose, because she is like one of the most naturally appealing actors working today. And this movie hopefully is a good like kicking off point for that. And ditto Gosling, you know, who spent many years post Mickey Mouse Club being very stern and serious and, you know, monosyllabic. And Barbie seems to have unlocked something in him where he was like, oh, right, I do have that whole other side of my charisma. Let me use it. So hopefully the Fall Guy will do well enough that both actors are encouraged to seek out more things like this.
Yeah, it's a great meeting point for the two of them. There's some other wonky elements of this movie. Stephanie Hsu shows up for essentially one scene. I'm not sure if that role was cut down a lot, but it felt strangely out of place to me. A lot of pretty noticeable ADR, things like that, where you're just like, how did this come together in the end?
Yeah, yeah. It's trying to be Shaggy, but it's maybe too Shaggy.
Yes, yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. For our purposes, we should also talk about a real campaign behind this movie and function of this movie is to highlight the world of stunts.
Yeah.
The director, David Leitch, and his wife, who produced the film, Kelly McCormick, have been very vocal about using this as a platform to get a stunt Oscar on the... you know, on the telecast.
No, and in the end credits even like show the stunt performers doing their work on the film. Yeah, it's a very pro stunt person. And I mean, it makes the case that has already been well made elsewhere, you know, that these are huge, huge parts of many, many movies. And like, as I think they say in the movie, most movies have stunt performers. It's not just action movies. And so that deserves to be recognized. And yeah, as a testament to that, I think The Fall Guy works really well.
Yep.
As a sort of Shane Black pastiche, maybe less so.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, J. Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49%, based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com. Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's greatest controversies. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when their adoring fans learned about the infamous lip-syncing, their downfall was swift and brutal. With exclusive interviews from frontman Fab Morvan and his producers Frank Farian and Ingrid Segeith, this podcast takes a fresh look at the exploitation of two young Black artists. Binge all episodes of Blame It on the Fame, Milli Vanilli, ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Well, in far more niche news, localized news, let's say, we'll go from Hollywood to New York and talk. We want to talk a little bit about the Tony nominations, mainly as a preview for a larger Tony episodes to come. A lot of big names this year, Richard. A lot of names I know from way out here in Los Angeles.
I know. I mean, in one category alone,
Best Actress in a Play is like, what is going on there?
Jessica Lange, Rachel McAdams, Sarah Paulson, Amy Ryan, and then Betsy Idem is the lone, you know, more theatery actress.
Well, and a long, great actor.
Yeah.
It's a thrill to see her there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's been an interesting season for Tonys. Everything is, you know, in the spring season, everything opens from basically mid-March through the end of this month. So I have been in Times Square many, many more times than I care to be in any given month. But yeah, it's been good. And I think on the musical side, maybe things are a little quieter than the plays. But, you know, you have things like The Outsiders, which is an adaptation of the S.E. Hinton novel and actually does work pretty well. Partly because the music is really beautiful. You have the Alicia Keys musical, Hell's Kitchen. So that's a big name there. Water for Elephants, based on a big book that was a sort of forgotten movie. So yeah, it feels glitzier than it has in recent years. And I don't think there's a lot of tension about who's going to win things necessarily. Like, I think Jeremy Strong, who's nominated for an Enemy of the People, will probably win lead actor for a play. I guess actress is a little more competitive, but my money is still on Sarah Paulson for a play called Appropriate.
Yeah, Sarah Paulson's been writing incredible reviews for that for many, many months now. There are a lot of interesting narratives there. I profiled Amy Ryan about her very, very last minute fill-in on Doubt for Time Daily. And Jessica Lange is Jessica Lange. but yeah, I've heard the most about Sarah Paulson, so that feels like the safe bet.
The one win I think would be really great is in leading actress in a musical. The great Marion Plunkett, who's been, you know, sort of a working character actor for many, many years. She is nominated for The Notebook. So she basically plays the Jenna Rowlands, the role that Jenna Rowlands played in the film. And it's not a big singing part. She sings once at the very end, but it's mostly just like an acting role where she plays a woman who's kind of lost in a haze of dementia. And she's really good in it. That show as a whole, less good, I'll say. But like, she's really great. And that would just be a really fun kind of thing to have in her resume that she won, you know, a musical Tony. I mean, she's been in musicals in the past. She's gotten awards for them. But, you know, sort of later in her career, I would like to see that happen, with apologies to Kelly O'Hara, who's very good in Days of Wine and Roses. And Gail Rankin, who's in Cabaret, which I'm seeing tonight.
All right. Nominee, Gail Rankin. Mm-hmm. The nominating committee was not fully seduced by star power. It's worth noting Steve Carell was not nominated for Uncle Vanya. In his place, perhaps, was William Jackson Harper, his co-star in that play, whom I heard far more positive things about, let's say. And to your earlier point about musicals and this being not as, you know, blockbuster of a year, the play Stereophonic is nominated for score. That's a pretty rare occurrence. And it seems to have sucked up a lot of that musical oxygen as the front runner in that category.
Yeah, Stereophonic is a really great play that is about a Fleetwood Mac-esque band recording a Rumours-esque album. And a member of the band The Arcade Fire wrote the original songs that you hear in snippets as they record and record and record over the course of the play's 3-hour run. And they're really great. And they're great to the point that I think it could win, which would be, I think it's happened in the past, but it's very rare for the best score to go to something that is not, you know, a musical.
Right.
And that play is a big phenomenon. It's nominated a lot of places. I think it's going to win best play. Several of the actors are nominated. Maybe they'll cancel each other out or maybe they won't. I don't know.
All right. Well, more on all of that very soon. Yes. I hope I get to see some of these shows, as we all should, because it sounds like a great season. Well, on to Hacks. The third season of Hacks premiered Thursday on Max. Two episodes are going up weekly. I was pretty skeptical going into this third season. They had ended the show, which is centered on this Vegas comic, this legendary Vegas comic played by Jean Smart and this protege who comes to write for her, played by Hannah Einbinder. The show for two seasons had depicted this very close, toxic relationship, and we'd kind of ended with them parting ways. And you wondered what kind of contrivance would come into play to keep the show going. Julie, you previewed the show for us, and I was pretty amazed by how well they did figure out how to keep the show going.
I know. It's wild because I spoke to creators, Paul W. Downs, Lucia Aniello, and Jen Statsky, and they spoke about pitching the show completely from start to end and how at this point they're not even halfway there. But yes, they spoke about knowing that, of course, over the course of this show, Deborah and Ava are going to split apart, come together, split apart, come together. So they wanted to find a way each time to make it seem, you know, not quite so hacky or cliched, them getting together. You know, they were hoping that this reunion sort of deepens the relationship in a way. So it's interesting. They run into each other at a Las Vegas hotel. in an elevator, and pretty quickly they're back in Deborah's room, and they're talking about the Tom Cruise white chocolate cake, which to me, that's just such a perfect Hacks detail, this very yes. pop culture specific detail that marks, of course, Deborah's ascent, but also Hannah's weird pop culture interest.
Sorry, is that the Tom Cruise coconut cake?
How the hell did you know that?
It's a famous cake. Every Christmas he sends one to his entire contact list. I've read about it for years. Kirsten Dunst said it was one of the best cakes she's ever had, and she was a Marie Antoinette.
Well, I guess Tom just saw the special and he loved it.
That's cool. How is it?
Fantastic. That was very funny.
Haha. I mean the cake.
I'm off sugar now.
Once the show got to the Tom Cruise cake, I was sold on them being reconciled. Did you feel the same way?
I felt exactly the same way. That is a pivotal moment in that first episode, because it also signals that the show knows these characters well enough at this point that they don't need to do too much work. They can have some fun, and they can trust that we want to see them together in a way where we don't need to do a ton of legwork to get them to that point. The show's always had this really intriguing, at times not always perfectly calibrated mixture of mean and nice. You know, Deborah, Jean Smart plays her as this very acid-tongued, short-fused celebrity, really. Mm-hmm. How unbelievable, right? How unrealistic.
Yeah.
But this season, there's a warmth between these two women and more of an equal playing field that I thought was really satisfying and made their dynamic together a lot richer, at least as I saw it.
Yeah, they have a shared mission in this season. That's kind of the overarching plot of the season. And yeah, it's fun seeing them spar. It's also fun seeing them collaborate. I think the show is a pretty good mix of kind of character drama almost and half-hour comedy. I think I miss maybe a few like laugh out loud jokes per episode. Like I think they could maybe turn that dial up a little bit, but at the same time, they're trying to make it a credible depiction of the entertainment industry. This is not 30 Rock where absurdist things are happening all the time. And so you kind of can't go too antic with that, I guess.
There are a few details there that I really appreciate this season. And it shows they know what they're talking about. One is the cake that Julie mentioned, yep. The Tom Cruise cake, mm-hmm. Those who know, know. One is what we see Ava doing at the beginning of the season. She's writing for a John Oliver-esque late night show, which is very news topic heavy. And I think the show gets in some good digs at that format. That may be a little meta as well, because Hacks also isn't as funny as your average 30-minute comedy series contender, perhaps. And then you have the overarching plot you mentioned, Richard, which is that a more typical late night seat has been vacated or is about to be vacated. And Deborah emerges as this candidate, and these two, and Ava reunites with her to work on securing her that spot. And it's really exciting journey for them with a lot of momentum. That also just along the way gets in a lot of details about the state of network television, audience viewership, comedy, et cetera, that this show seems to know really well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that there is, the show does have the DNA to be more traditional sitcom where it's, you know, less serialized, but they've kind of decided to just make it sort of one long season, you know, long narrative. But there are these occasional interruptions throughout the season where there's sort of standalone episodes. I appreciate that sort of format, but I don't always know that, like, an episode where they get lost in the woods, like, okay, you know, the show has trained you to be like, every episode is going to advance the plot. And so when an episode kind of doesn't, it feels out of place, even if in a broader sense, I kind of crave standalone episodes, if that makes any sense.
Like, yeah, absolutely.
It's trying to do the thing I want, but also at the same time, I don't want it in this context somehow.
Right. I like seeing Deborah and Ava go to a frat party, but right. I don't know that it moves
yes.
along, right? The plot.
Yes. Julie, I wonder what you make of what Richard's saying in the context of what you spoke with the creators about in terms of their broader plan for the series, how they see the series. The show is more of a dramedy, I think it's safe to say, than a straight-up comedy. And it does have ambitions for its characters and its storytelling that I find at times surprising. And at times, I agree with Richard, getting slightly in the way of a more straightforwardly pleasurable comic experience.
Right. Well, to them, the show is very much about this sort of tortured mentorship between Deborah and Ava. And the way they speak about it is more as a study in maybe power and toxic codependency and sort of working through those issues. And I got the sense that they would, you know, try to explore those issues in, of course, as funny of a way as they can work their way into. But that to me, I told them that honestly, sometimes I feel triggered by the show because the boundarylessness of Deborah is to me just too toxic. And even though Ava does have more power this season, we see even at the end of episode 2, when she finally shows up at Deborah's house, she walks inside and Deborah says, "Shoes off." So it's always sort of this push-pull dynamic between them. And that was mainly what my conversation with the creators was about, that and that Tom Cruise cake, which they all tried, by the way, and which was served at the party, the premiere party. They said it was crucial. They said, surprisingly, it was very white chocolate forward, which they would not have expected.
That shocks me, frankly.
Right. but they served it at the premiere party last week that our colleague Kara Warner went to and covered. So I thought that was a clever tie-in.
They know what they're doing.
They do.
Speaking of that party, which I heard many good things about from many who attended, Hacks is very much back up and running as a contender. It took a year off due to some health issues that Jean Smart was experiencing. It's back in top form. The buzz is very strong. I expect it to be a pretty formidable player up against the Bear. How do I put this? Richard, a few weeks ago on this show, you made the comment that you did not believe the Bear was a good show. And I've heard about that comment from some listeners. I'm gonna tell you that right now. but I wanna give you the chance to talk about that a little bit more broadly, because I know what you meant and I know what you were specifically talking about in terms of its comedic qualities and its place in this race. And I think Hacks ties into that in an interesting way, given what we were saying.
Yeah, I mean, the Bear is not a comedy. Like, there are funny things happen in it, but funny things also happened on The West Wing, you know? it's a workplace drama, and it does not belong in a comedy category, and they're kind of cheating by doing it. Maybe the original intention was to have it be a comedy, but the jokes to serious stuff ratio is very off for the show to be competing in the comedy category at the Emmys. My other feelings about The Bear, we can say for another episode. I think that show tries hard, kind of too hard to be something profound, and sort of loses the forest for the trees in that pursuit. But it's just so silly to see something like The Bear going up against Hacks, which is not an old school kind of TV comedy, but it is, you know, more in that format than a lot of the other shows competing against it.
Yeah, there's been this debate around Hacks for a number of years of, for example, how funny is Deborah's comedy supposed to be? And it's been such a constant point of discussion with this show, because it is about the world of comedy and it is not always that funny, that I feel like you run into these barriers almost in terms of talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's so hard to...
It's hard to write comedy.
Yeah, I mean, to reference another Sorkin show, like when they showed us the comedy on Studio 60, it was like, this show would be canceled in the middle of its first episode. Like, it's Hacks is better about that. And you know,
it's called Hacks, too.
Yeah, and Deborah is supposed to be an older school comedian, kind of like rimshot style, you know, one-liners, that kind of thing. And so, and Ava's there to sort of push her into a new sort of, into the present tense, basically. And even when she does successfully do that, is the comedy that funny? No, but she's supposed to be broadly appealing. She's hawking stuff on QVC, you know? She's not in like little comedy clubs in Brooklyn. But I think the external comedy, which is to say the funny stuff that happens to the characters, not the funny things that they're doing on stage, that is, you know, there's a lot of funny stuff. They mostly rely on the sort of side characters to kind of punch a scene with a joke. But I keep comparing this show to the other two, which is also a showbiz comedy that when it recently ended. And that was more in line with, like, you know, there was a joke every 30 seconds, basically. And I do sometimes wish that Hacks, again, would format itself that way, but that's just not the show they're trying to make, I guess.
The other two also just cut a lot deeper.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, I mean, the thing about Hacks is, like, it's really enjoyable to watch as a sort of, like, you know, peering into rich people's lives and peering in behind the curtain of show business in a way that Entourage was. And I'm not comparing them in any other way beyond that. But, like, Entourage was not a very funny show, but it was, like, you know, engaging and amusing. And I think Hacks is also more amusing, let's say, than it is laugh out loud funny.
It's also a really strong character piece.
Yeah.
And Jean Smart particularly is so good this season in all areas. She's very funny. She nails the dramatic material. She anchors the show beginning to end. Julie, I'm curious where you fall on all that and how funny Hacks is.
I agree with Richard. I also agree with Richard's thoughts on the bear.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
But I don't want Hacks to laugh at Deborah's set, I guess. Mm-hmm. But yeah. I agree that, you know, sometimes I find myself laughing more at the Kayla and Jimmy storylines. And I love that they sort of pulled those two characters apart, Jerry Maguire style, from the agency. So they're off on their own. And, you know, the little lines, like finding out that Jimmy's mother is Deidre Hall, like that to me is a laugh out loud moment. And I feel like they're capable maybe of more of those. I guess I feel greedy asking for more of those because you're right. There are so few comedies, quote unquote, out there now that actually make me laugh out loud. Yeah. But I just appreciate that I get these moments of, you know, Deidre Hall and Tom Cruise.
It's not comedy that necessarily translates in the broadest way, which I wouldn't want it to. But it's a marked shift from, you know, what a comedy series Emmy contender was 20 years ago or even 10 years ago.
Yeah, especially when you consider that on Hacks in its past seasons, a lot of times the most effective moments are the serious ones. You know, the moments when Ava loses her cool and blows up at Deborah, you know, when there's some sort of reckoning between the two of them. And that's pretty much straight drama at that point. And, you know, you look at the shows that Hacks is up against. There's The Bear. Only Murders is more, you know, traditional comedy. Abbott Elementary is a network sitcom, albeit not a multi-camera one. What We Do in the Shadows. But I think the big standout that Hacks is going up against is the final season of Curb Your Enthusiasm, which was never trying to be anything but a laugh-out-loud comedy. And maybe this the final season wasn't quite as successful in that as past seasons have been. But I don't know. I kind of see a possibility that Curb Your Enthusiasm, representing an older time for television comedy, could kind of best these more modern favorites.
Curb Your Enthusiasm's first Emmy nomination in this category came in 2002, 22 years ago.
That's wild.
It was nominated against, in addition to a fellow groundbreaking HBO show in Sex and the City, Friends, Everybody Loves Raymond, and Will and Grace. If there is a Tom Cruise cake joke in there, it is surrounded by humor that is 20 times as broad.
Right.
Yeah. 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 No, exactly. And at the time, it's funny, Curb Your Enthusiasm was greeted as this weird, like, almost arty outlier because they were like, it's improv. And, like, you know, it was single camera, which was pretty rare back then. And
very intra-Hollywood.
Very intra-Hollywood. And it's funny now that, I mean, I guess it's 22 years of 22 years, but it's just funny that Curb Your Enthusiasm is sort of the old stalwart when back in the day it was anything but.
Mm-hmm. And according to Jerry Seinfeld, you can't even make shows like that anymore. He said recently on the New Yorker Radio Hour that PC culture is killing shows like that.
It used to be you would go home at the end of the day. Most people would go, oh, Cheers is on. Oh, MASH is on. Oh, Mary Tyler Moore is on. All in the Family's on. You just expected there'll be some funny stuff we can watch on TV tonight. Well, guess what? Where is it? This is the result of the extreme left and PC crap. And people worrying so much about offending other people. Mm-hmm. When you write a script and it goes into four or five different hands, committees, groups, here's our thought about this joke. Well, that's the end of your comedy. They move the gates, like in skiing.
Yeah.
Culture, the gates are moving. Your job is to be agile and clever enough that wherever they put the gates, I'm going to make the gate.
Well, I do kind of wonder if the Jerry Seinfeld stuff puts some sort of stain on Curb Your Enthusiasm somehow. I don't know. I don't know that Emmy voters are really paying attention to things in that way. But
the other tonal quality of Hacks I'd love to talk about in relation to the race overall is that watching this season, in many ways, it felt like the sweetest season so far. And that coincided with me feeling like it was the strongest position as a contender. Because sweet is something that Emmy voters have started to really prioritize in the comedy categories, and that you could argue viewers have prioritized in their comedies. I'm thinking of shows like Ted Lasso, Schitt's Creek, and honestly, even to an extent, The Bear. There's a lot of storytelling in that vein, in that quality. And I don't know. I don't know what to make of that trend. I mean, there's a lot of really obvious, everything's terrible conclusions one can draw there, but there is something specific going on about the gravitation toward that tone.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's cozy. I kind of, I don't know if I credit or blame The Office, which like over the years and in kind of tandem for a while with Parks and Recreation, like I mean, those shows were always joke machines, but like in their latter seasons, they were really like about sort of the sentiment and the sweetness of this little group of people that you've spent so much time with. And The Office has rewatched and rewatched and rewatched as sort of a comfort object. Mm-hmm. And I think that seeped into the comedy genre as a whole on television. And it's not my favorite thing because I don't know. I miss the days when things were pretty starkly defined as like the hour longs make you feel this way and the half hours make you feel that way. And maybe that's just me being an old reactionary. But I also think that people get their comedy now online. They get it on TikTok. They get it, you know, in memes or whatever. That's your laugh out loud stuff. And the half hour format is more built around a different kind of sentiment than you get in hour longs, which are much darker often.
I wish there was more specific criteria to establish a comedy as a comedy. I wish there was like a room where 10 people sat and they had to actually laugh out loud. X number of times.
Exactly. Yeah. Sorry, you only got 9 laughs. So here,
drama you go.
Yeah.
The thing is that They did for a time, and I don't know the state of this rule, they separated into like half hour and hour. I think there was the Orange is the New Black swapping back and forth. That was in that period of time. By that measure, like Sugar on Apple TV Plus would be a comedy this year. And that's the best that they've come up with in terms of how to actually have a rule in terms of what the difference is. The Bear, meanwhile, is an hour 15-minute episode this season in Seven Fishes. Which is the least funny episode of the year, maybe. But here we are. It's very hard to differentiate. And so I think that's why you see shows like Ted Lasso, or I was thinking of Jury Duty last season, that find a lot of love because they are heartwarming in the way that older sitcoms were, but they don't have that same sharpness. I mean, even if you watch a Will and Grace episode from 2002, I think it would be striking to a lot of people how much sharper it is than some of the comedies. And by sharper, I just mean like, you know, a little stab than some of the comedies that are getting embraced today.
Yeah. And then you look over at what's competing in drama and there's The Curse and you're like, that's funnier than all these, than a lot of these comedies, you know? And I wonder like where, if they did something where they said, okay, forget it. We're not making these distinctions between comedy and drama anymore. We're just saying best show, you know, and we're just saying best actor in a show. We're not separating them because the line has been blurred. Do we think that some sort of inherent bias, longstanding, you know, whatever, the more dramatic, traditionally dramatic shows would always beat the lighter stuff?
That's a great question.
I do.
Yeah. Like, could something like Hacks actually go up against The Crown? You know?
I don't know. If it was like Frasier, right?
Yeah. Frasier's back in the race.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Having not seen any of that reboot, I can't evaluate its dramatic qualities, but I'm not against it.
Yeah, I mean, because like, you know, or you create a third category where something like, you know, like The Bear could exist in, or even Hacks to some extent, or The Gilded Age, like The Gilded Age.
Slow Horses has a lot of comedy. Mr. and Mrs. Smith had a lot of comedy. I mean, it does feel, I mean, The Morning Show really fits into that Gilded Age category. I think of how camp do you want to call it? But yeah, these distinctions are so vague. And one point you've made a lot, Richard, is that I think when it comes to developing half-hour comedies for streamers and networks, it actually makes it more difficult to actually develop funny ones because the shows that are getting embraced, they don't have to be as funny. And so what's the appeal in that when humor is a little bit more subjective to begin with?
Yeah, and I don't agree with Jerry Seinfeld on anything. I just want to.
I do want to be very clear. But, we are edging toward Jerry territory, and we're not there. But, I promise.
But I think buried in a lot of bullshit that he said recently, there is something where it's like, yeah, we kind of just don't make funny shows anymore. Like, yeah. There always has to be this kind of roundness to it, this sort of human element. And that stuff has its place. But back in the day, that's what made The Office, the American Office, feel kind of revolutionary, where it was like, we're laughing at this buffoon and this silly guy in the office and whatever, whatever. But, ooh, here's this kind of more serious plot point that is interesting. But, and look, shows have done that for a long time. It was on Friends. It was on shows, you know, well before Friends. But I don't know, The Office kind of invented it new, and then everyone sort of seized on that. And in the past, you know, 20 years or so, like, they forgot the other part, the original part, which is the comedy, you know. And I think it would be kind of revolutionary now if a streamer or a network put out something that really felt like, you know, an old school sitcom. I just don't know if they're the people in the town anymore who know how to do that.
Yep. It's a broader question about who's developing television, what's going on in writers' rooms. I mean, it's really bottom up, and that's the process that's missing. And
yeah.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
To close, perhaps, along these lines, what is a show that really made you laugh this season that you hope gets recognized that's maybe not in the center of that conversation? Julie, why don't we start with you?
Well, I was just going to say, if The Bear is considered a comedy, I would consider Succession to be a comedy. That show made me laugh so hard at certain points.
It really did. So
Curb Your Enthusiasm still makes me laugh. You know, it's Always Sunny in Philadelphia is kind of
enduringly great.
Yes, that makes me laugh out loud. What about you guys?
I mean, I mentioned it already, but I did in a sort of like horrified way laugh at the Curse a lot. It's being slotted as a drama. But like Emma Stone and Nathan Fielder are very funny on that show. But maybe I'm part of the problem because mostly what I laugh at now is like some dumb meme I see or some cat video. Like, I don't know. But, you know, I think that there have been enough good things on SNL this season that I know it's in a different category, right? But like that still, you know, the Jumanji sketch, for example, like I laughed at that way more than I have any of the, you know, eligible TV shows we've spoken about.
Yeah. I know we're big fans of Girls 5 Eva, and that is mm-hmm. one that
yep.
has struggled to find an audience even on Netflix. But certainly the Tina Fey school and her writers on 30 Rock that have gone on to create their own shows prove that there's still greatness to be found in good old-fashioned joke writing, and that show is no exception. I would love to go on a limb for Loot on Apple TV Plus, a show I didn't love the show in its first season. I don't even know that it's an exception to what we're talking about in terms of being more cozy vibes than great jokes in season two, but it's really strong this season. And to me, it's a prime example of what we're losing in TV sitcom making, which is the ability to slowly build out a great ensemble, a great sensibility, a great comic sensibility with reduced episode counts, more likely cancellations. A lot of those shows we were talking about from 25 years ago took years to find themselves and like dozens of episodes. Loot has aired 16. It is in a far better place than where it began, and I hope it gets a little bit of embrace that would help its chances to further grow.
Yeah, I feel like the buzz around it has been really good this season. Yeah. So, yeah, that could be. And what I've seen of it, I do. Yeah, it is. It's funny.
Well, we will be talking about these shows much more. And Julie, you have an interview with Jean Smart, which we can tease. That's going up next week. We're very excited to hear that.
She was wonderful. She spoke a lot about that power dynamic between Ava and Deborah, but also just some of Deborah's skeletons, you know, from the past, and also what her relationship with Hannah Einbinder's like offset. It was a good conversation.
Legend. That does it for this week's show. You can email us anytime at littlegoldmen@vf.com, or you can find us on the internet. I'm at David Canfield 97, and Richard?
Rylos.
And Julie?
Julie W. Miller.
Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs. And this week's award for the thing that we most hope happens to Richard or me this year at Cannes goes to Julie Miller.
A reverse Notting Hill.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.